We're doing in Yaakov, we're on page Mem Amud Beis, it says 80 on the top right corner. The Gemara had described that when Hashem gave the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, so the words scattered in 70 languages. And now the Gemara is going to bring support to that. When we read the Gemara and it tells us things that sound agadic, so we often apply the Rambam and the Meiri in understanding the Agadic parts of Talmud. It's challenging to know exactly how to apply it. We're taught the Midrash that when Hashem gave the Torah, He offered it to the nations in advance. We read that Midrash, it sounds like something, what happened? Hashem appeared to each nation and asked them, how did that happen? Then we open the Rambam in Igeret Teiman, in the Yemenite epistle, and the Rambam describes that Hashem sent a prophet to each nation to offer them the Torah. So the Rambam takes that Medrash and adds a point, describes it in a way that sounds less fantastic, more understandable to the human ear. The Rambam might answer for us, how come we find codes of Hammurabi? How come we find in different places laws that can have similarities to Torah? And Rambam says, well, our sages said the Torah was offered to nations before it was offered to the Jewish people. And that means there were prophets that went to nations and offered them the Torah. Was the Torah they were offered identical to ours? We would have thought, yes. Does that mean that afterwards they could have taken what they were offered, taken some of it, adapted it, adopted it? Also, yes. But what we see from that Midrash is that before Torah was given to the Jewish people, Hashem did send to the world some versions of Torah, whatever that means. That's Rambam saying, long before they found Hammurabi, Rambam wrote that 700 years ago. We have that in the Rambam's letter, that interpretation of the Medrash. So when we read Midrashim, we very often have to take a step back and say, what is the Medrash telling me? Let's not remain on the fifth grade level of taking the Medrash as being very literal. The Medrash is giving over a message. Sometimes it is literal, sometimes it isn't, and we don't always know, but we pay attention and we try to get the message. Over here, when we're taught that the Torah was given into 70 languages, or in other places the Talmud tells us that the written law was translated to 70 languages, that has halachic relevance. We understand that to mean, as is written in the response of the Chasam Sofer, that the written Torah was made available to the nations. And as such, we are allowed to teach the written Torah to non-Jews. The oral Torah, we're not. The oral Torah, a person has to be Jewish in order to have access to the oral Torah. But the written Torah, there's no problem teaching it, translating it, making it available, because it was already translated way back when. So you have a Midrash, you have a story in Talmud, and then you have halachic ramifications. Sometimes the stories in Talmud cannot be taken for halachic ramifications. Sometimes we say, "En lemedim halacha me'agada." You can't learn halacha from a story. So again, the more you'll learn, the more you'll develop that refinedness, that understanding of when do I and when don't I take lesson from the story. One of the dangers is that very often children and people who have not developed skills in Talmud will take stories and or Hasidic stories or stories in Midrash, and that will be their guiding principle in life. That they will hear a story and that story teaches them, and we don't learn halacha from stories unless we know who's telling over the story, who the story is about, and the person who the story is about, we know that he did it with an intention to teach people from his actions. Sometimes in private we do something that doesn't mean we want everyone to know about it, doesn't mean that we want people to learn a lesson from that. It might be that there are circumstances where that's what's right for so-and-so and it's not right for others. It's not so simple to learn from a story a practical application. So that's the balance when we learn Midrash. There were three hands up, so you were first, I think.
Me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, I'm sorry. You were second. Benny was first. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
You come back to me.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. kind of a slippery slope, isn't it? When there's this line drawn between teaching the written, teaching the oral, and the home. I mean,
correct.
It's pretty hard to maintain.
Agreed.
Not okay.
Agreed, and in Machon Meir, part of what we rely on, we're making all these classes available. I have no idea who's watching them online. But our approach is I'm making them available to the Jewish people. Now, the fact that other people can access it, that's not my issue. I don't have to worry about it. It doesn't say I have to seal it and say sign in with a code and tell us when you were born and who your mother is. And
yeah.
I don't have to do that. I'm saying I make it available. It's yes. Yes.
Gemara is one thing, but you take books that are more hidden away, like Sefer Yetzirah or Zohar, and then would that also be okay to just, you know, put it on the radio, let's say?
It's a good question for Thursday night. It's not our topic. It's a good question. Let's revisit it Thursday night. I think he was first. I'll get you in second. Yes?
I just also wanted to have that, like, what about
I don't know how it works with the oral law here. I don't know how the classes work here. That's
a step, as although there's a growing between time, everything is obviously a lot different to the
truth. I don't know what goes on here. That has to be Esther of Listman or the teachers of Talmud. I don't know. And, I don't know.
They're not Talmud class, only Jews.
No, I heard that Rob Weiss's class turned on the way now. That was a change a couple of years back. So I heard.
I don't know.
That the people here are serious about being 16 times to be Jewish. I don't know.
I would just add a point. We had in the past year two students who were in the heat of the gear process and they pulled out. And I view them as being serious. I view them as being very serious. Right. I wouldn't say I'm saying the word serious shouldn't have the wrong connotation. I think a person that takes things seriously and says, it's not for me, is also serious.
Very, very much.
I don't.
I meant that, you know, in this day and age where people can get a heck of a lot on the internet, this and that, people have no intention of being Jewish. And will.
Okay.
That gets to my question, by the way. So I said, if you've got an error here, isn't, I don't think, maybe the most serious. You can ask Rav Listman, but that. So my question is related to that. It's if one cannot understand the written Torah correctly without the oral law, then to say that you can pass it to the nation seems begging it for confusion.
See, this wasn't our topic. I see. Yes. I think for the most part, if a person studies the written Torah without the oral Torah, they're not going to get it right. But their mistakes are not so far-fetched. I'll explain. So the Torah says an eye for an eye. And our tradition says it doesn't mean that literally. We don't take the person's eye out. What would happen if a non-Jew would read that and say, okay, in my legal system, now in New Zealand, Saudi Arabia, okay, an eye for an eye. Is that the end of the world? Again, is it illegitimate to say that if someone on purpose took out someone else's eye, they'll have their own eye taken out? We don't apply it that way. Our tradition is not to apply it that way, but is it so far from what, like he's saying, what's going on in Saudi Arabia today, right?
No, that example, you could probably, there are people who feel, I think that was Hammurabi, or pretty
yeah,
close.
Sure, it was.
I mean, yeah, so that, but there are other examples that, you know, I mean, it's hard enough for us to understand, as, you know, you talk about teaching Gemara, and I'm just a beginner, but, you know, you'll get it wrong a few times before you get it right, and I don't know, don't they say it was a tragedy when it was written in Greek?
That needs explanation. That's a good question. I was hoping someone would ask that. But again, this was all intro. We didn't even start.
The other day we have 54 million Koreans learning Talmud.
Okay. So, can we start? I don't want to skip over anyone. Let's begin now, Ben Yaakov. So, the point was that when we read these midrashim, we should understand them on multiple levels. Sometimes we'll only understand the pshat, sometimes we'll understand more. We should recognize there's more than meets the eye. Even if I didn't get to it, I should realize there's more here. Tana debei Rabbi Ishmael. The following Tanai quote, meaning this isn't a Mishnah, it is what we call a Braita, something that's external to the Mishnah. It's something that was learned by the rabbis in the Tanaic period, but did not make it into the Mishnah. And it was studied in the academy of Rabbi Ishmael. So Tana Debei Rabbi Ishmael means this is a Tanaic quote that was studied in the academy, or that was quoted or validated in the academy of Rabbi Ishmael. Now, we will sometimes encounter Braitot that begin with that intro, and sometimes it will begin with the intro, Debei Rabbi Ishmael Tana. In the academy of Rabbi Ishmael, the following Braita was taught. What's the difference? So we have a tradition that when it says Tana Debei Rabbi Ishmael, the Gemara is saying, I'm backing this. This is a quote that was in their academy, and it has my backing, it should have halachic weight. You should go with this Braita. When it's quoted as Debei Rabbi Ishmael Tana in the academy of Rabbi Ishmael, that's where they learned this Braita. So what the Gemara is saying is, I don't necessarily agree with it, but in the academy of Rabbi Ishmael, they taught the following. And it takes away from its validity, it takes away from its halachic weight. So we have two ways of quoting it. Tana Debei Rabbi Ishmael or Debei Rabbi Ishmael. Tana, do I say they learned in his academy? Or I say, in his academy, they learned the following. In other words, and I don't necessarily give it as much backing, the Talmud saying, or I'm detracting from its backing. It says in the verse, in the Pasuk in Jeremiah and Yirmiyahu, Uchefatish yifotzetz sela. Just as a hammer explodes a rock. Now, in Hebrew, the word, the verb, sometimes goes forward and sometimes goes backwards. The hammer explodes the rock. Does it mean the rock explodes the hammer, or the hammer explodes the rock? Where do I put the comma? The hammer, comma, explodes the rock, meaning the rock explodes the hammer, or the hammer explodes, comma, the rock. The hammer is exploding the rock. Two opinions, Rashi and Tosfos, how we read this pasuk. And this shows up in a few places in Talmud, this pasuk and this machloket Rashi Tosfos. Ma patish ze nechlak lekama nitzotzot. Just like a hammer will explode into shards, into sparks in every direction. Af kol dibur v'dibur sheyatza mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So too, every statement that came out of God's mouth, nechlak l'shivim l'shonot, was divided into 70 languages. Okay? That doesn't seem to be so easy to understand. Why is it like a hammer? Why is it like a rock? So the words of the Torah are like a hammer. And sometimes the hammer has to pierce a rock. And if we're talking about going to the 70 nations, maybe it's not so natural to them. Chazal say that the soul of a Jew has a natural flow with the Torah. The soul of a ger has a natural flow with the Torah. The soul of someone who's not does not have a natural flow with the Torah. And then they will find the Torah to be tremendously tedious. Suddenly it becomes impossible. How can he keep Shabbos? How can he keep kosher? It's impossible. So it could be that's why it's described like a hammer hitting a rock. When it's going to the 70 nations, so on the one hand you have the commandments, on the other hand it seems like very, 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 very tedious. Yes?
Doesn't it also describe a Tamid Chacham means to be very hard, like a Yishevotzetzela?
This pasuk is derived in many directions throughout Talmud. It shows up in many tractates and in multiple directions. Yes?
But how do we ever understand it at all? So how are you going to say this pasuk here means this, and the same pasuk somewhere else means something else?
Well, he has a good question that that doesn't mean we can answer it so quickly. There are multiple answers to your question, and they're all right. They just, in different contexts, it's a different format, meaning you could look, this concept appears in a few places, and I'm not sure which answer to give you, so I'm going to give you three of the answers, okay? Say that? So, one answer is, we have a concept called lav shebaklalot. I'm going to take the most basic halachic answer, which is not relevant here, because this is a pasuk in Prophets. It's not a halachic. This is all agadic. But we have to be familiar with the concept. We have a concept called lav shebaklalot, that sometimes the rabbis had a tradition that when the Torah prohibited something, the Torah said it in a way that was encompassing, so as to encompass multiple concepts. So the Torah says, lo tochelu al adam, don't eat over the blood. What does that mean? Does that mean after you slaughtered an animal and the blood is sitting there, don't eat without covering the blood? Does that mean don't eat after you executed a person who came to court and you found them guilty and you executed someone that day, so the court may not eat for the remainder of the day? Does that mean don't eat before you pray over your own blood in the morning? It means that and more. Those are three derivations, the Talmud says, and more. And they're all ruled halachically. Halachically, you're not supposed to eat before you pray over your own blood. You're not supposed to eat when you executed someone that day, the court fasts for the remainder of the day. You're not supposed to eat before covering the blood. There are many interpretations to the verse, and they are ruled halachically. So sometimes we have a prohibition, which is called lav shebaklalot, a prohibition which is encompassing. It's not only one thing. And the rabbi's tradition told them, this is something that's very encompassing. The Torah said, don't eat over the blood, sit and work on that, because it's telling you a concept which has many, many, many applications, and it's not only one thing. And as you go through Talmud, you see this pasuk popping up in different tractates telling me different things. And then you open up the Shulchan Aruch and you discover I rule like that. So that's concept number one. Okay? Concept number two is that sometimes we have the difference. So concept number one is true. Register it. Apply it. You'll see it as you travel Shas. Concept number two. Sometimes a pasuk is brought as a support to a concept, where our sages say, this is a concept we have on tradition. Let me show you a verse that's supportive of this concept. I didn't really derive it from the verse. I had this concept on tradition. But I'll show you a verse which you can learn as support. That's what we call in Talmud asmachta. It's supportive, but it's not really a derivation. You can't derive the concept from the verse. If the only source you had was the verse, you wouldn't derive it. So that's also true. That sometimes the Talmud will bring me a verse and tell me, here, this verse tells you A, and then this verse tells you B, and then this verse tells you C, and it doesn't seem to tell me any of them. And the answer is it doesn't, you're right, but it's supportive of many of them. So it's an asmachta. So that's the second concept. The third concept is sometimes the Gemara will tell me there are many derivations from a pasuk. And when I look closely at the commentaries, they analyze which letter or which format or sometimes the juxtaposition of the verse taught me that this one and that one and the next one. So I can have one verse teaching me many things, but I have to understand which word, which vowel. Sometimes it's the juxtaposition, just like we saw now that there's a difference between Tana Deber B'Yishmael and Deber B'Yishmael Tana. So too in Tanakh, the wording, the juxtaposition of the wording, the sometimes the verbiage, will alter the meaning or teach me new halachot. So the fact that I can have one verse teaching me 5 or 10 laws, and sometimes different laws, can stem from the fact that here I'm analyzing this word in the verse, here I'm analyzing the next word, here I'm analyzing this verse juxtaposed to the other verse, here I'm analyzing the extra vav, or the word that extrapolates in this verse. So yeah, it sounds like one verse is teaching me a lot. No, no, no. Here it's this word, here it's that word, here it's the juxtaposition, here it's the extra letter. Yeah, you could learn a lot from a verse. That's concept number three. There's more. I said there are multiple answers to your question. But those are three answers. And again, they work together. Sometimes it's this, sometimes that, sometimes the next one. I'll give you a fourth answer, okay? But which is also true. Sometimes, when the Talmud gives me many derivations from a pasuk, they are really all one derivation, which might be the case over here. It's one concept, only it's given a different clothing. In different contexts, the Gemara words it differently. Meaning when the Talmud tells me on this pasuk, the Talmud uses it always about Torah, and always about the Torah coming from heaven to me, being like a hammer coming down on a rock, and always about the idea of tremendous force and shards, like an explosion occurring when there's the meeting of God's Torah with the human being. The Talmud consistently uses the pasuk this way. One time the Talmud says it's the 70 languages, it expands to all places, and other times it says Torah has to penetrate every person. Different derivations from the pasuk. Are they really different? Or are they really just, each time it's presented a different way, but there's one theme that's being presented here. So that's a fourth answer, which might be the correct answer here. Okay? And there are more. Okay, four. I told you there are many answers, but I wasn't sure. I didn't want you to walk away with misconceptions, because this is a good, he said he's got a good point. So I am blaming it on you, because I thought it was only Benny who was bothered with this. I was going to say Benny will talk, but then I heard you're bothered. I said I can't leave and not address it. Okay, let's move on. Amar Rav Hananel Bar Papa. Rav Hananel Bar Papa taught my dichtiv. What does the verse mean? What it says in Mishlei and Proverbs? Shimu kinegidim adaber. Listen, because I'm going to tell you negidim. What does negidim mean? So the word nagid is a powerful ruler. Listen, because I will give you, I am Machiavelli's the prince. I will teach you how to be leaders. Negidim adaber. I will teach you leadership. Lamanim shalut divrei Torah kinegid. Why are the words of Torah compared to a ruler? To tell you, just as when you stand before a monarch, before a leader, before a ruler, he has the power to kill or to leave you alive. We learned that last night. King Saul is upset at Achimelech, so he says, you're dead. And he means it. And within an hour, Achimelech and all his family are dead. So when you're standing in front of a king, it's pretty scary, right? Right, the famous story, there was a Kohen who didn't want to get his hands dirty, the Talmud tells us. Whenever he'd do the service in the Beit HaMikdash, there was blood, so he said, I have to keep my hands clean. So he wore gloves, silk gloves, when he worked in the Beit HaMikdash, and the rabbi said, that's not right. It's an honor to get your hands dirty doing the work of Hashem. Don't wear gloves doing that. And he didn't listen. So they told him, you're going to pay for that. And he didn't listen. And then the king summoned him in. The king had a question. And the king had a discussion which animal he should bring. And he asked the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, which animal is a better sacrifice? And the Kohen Gadol answered him. But as he answered him, he made a move with his hand, showing like, isn't that obvious? It's that animal. So the king said, look, you had a very good point, but you shouldn't have made that move with your hand. So we're going to take off that hand. This is during the Herodic dynasty, yeah? So he ordered him to have his right hand cut off. So when he came to the executioner to have his right hand cut off, he paid a bribe, and he said, cut off the left hand so I could continue doing the work. So the executioner cut off his left hand. The king got word of it, and the king said, fine, so now we'll take off your right hand. And they took off his right hand, and he lost both hands. So this was the Kohen. The rabbis told him, you're desecrating the service of Hashem when you show you have to wear gloves. You can't get dirty doing the service of Hashem. And he wouldn't listen to them. And the rabbis saw in his punishment a fulfillment of his punishment for what he had done in the service of Hashem. But here you see one move. He made an incorrect move, gesture with his hand. And the king says goodbye to that hand. So you stand in front of a king. The king can keep one alive or get him dead. We see that today. I mean, you have that today in North Korea. You have that today in China. You have that today in Russia. You know, he died of lead poisoning, a bullet in his head, right? Lead poisoning. Right? I'm saying there are people who you stand in front of and you know that you said the wrong word, you could be dead. So that's Nagid. In the days of Chazal, that was the ruler. It's not clear today whether we make a blessing over seeing a king, because most kings don't have that power. They can't just say off with your head. I mean, what's the name? The head of North Korea can do that, right? Okay. But most kings today can't do that. The king of Spain can't do that. Donald Trump can't do that. I'm saying, so it's not... yes, okay.
It might be a bit of a sidetrack, but on that story, aren't Jews not supposed to be Atzeri? Isn't that Atzeri?
Thursday night? Yes, sir.
Don't you need both hands?
Yes. Yes.
One, you would still be Pasul.
Yeah, good point. Coming back to our Gemara. So The Gemara says, Managid ze, this ruler, yesh bo la'amitu la'chayot, it's in his capacity to kill or keep alive. Af divrei Torah, you should realize that when you're standing in front of the Torah, you're standing in front of a force that's no different. Yesh bo la'amitu la'chayot. When you're studying Torah, you should know Torah could give you the best life, but Torah can kill you. Don't assume that learning Torah is a panacea. That's it. Life is perfect because I learned Torah. No. If Torah is learned wrongly, Torah can kill you. You have to work on Torah in order for it to be a source of life. Torah can be misapplied. It's not just I learned Torah so I can get it right. No. You could learn Torah and get it wrong. You could learn Torah and in the name of Torah do things that are very, very wrong. Just because a person learned Torah does not mean that he will be a source of blessing to the world. He has the responsibility to use the Torah and apply the Torah, develop himself through the Torah so that he will be a source of blessing to the world. But he has to realize he's being given a tool. My kids asked me, Abba, is it right that you should rather get killed than hold an iPhone in your hand? I said, I hold an iPhone in my hand. Obviously, I don't think so. So they said, why not? I said, an iPhone is a tool. Yeah, whoever told you that is right, that through an iPhone you could definitely access things that are destructive. Whoever told you that is right, that most people that hold an iPhone in their hand are doing things sometimes that they shouldn't be doing, to the point where they would have been much better off not holding that tool in their hand. But you cannot say that the tool is Yarek Val Yavo. It's a tool. Television is not bad. Television is a tool. So they said, really, Abba? I said, yeah. They were like shocked. I said, you know, sometimes I let you watch movies, like when we go to the store, to the electronics store, and they have all these nature movies on there. I say, go watch. If I thought it was so bad, why do I let you watch it? Because it's not so bad. It's something, it's a tool. It's a waste of time. There are definitely negative things that are being portrayed through there, but it's a tool. When we approach Torah, it would be a mistake to think, I'm getting something that is just life, that is just great, that is just wonderful. No, you're being given the most powerful tool. But you have to realize it can also be the most destructive tool. If a person walks out of yeshiva and says, I know Torah. So now, you guys will better listen to me. And not only that, I can tell everyone what they're doing wrong. This is called, I'm sorry to tell you, Baal Tshuva syndrome. Right? Now that I learned something, I can tell my neighbor he's got it all wrong because I know something. It's very common that when a person is in the tshuva process, so suddenly everyone's wrong. Everyone he looks at is doing something wrong. No one's pious enough. No one's good enough. No shul is kosher enough. In this shul they talk. In this shul they daven too fast. In that shul they're not nice to the old man who comes in. Everywhere he goes he sees something wrong. It's a syndrome. It's a tendency we can have. The Talmud says, you learn Torah. Torah can be the cure for life, but Torah can also be the drug for death. Torah can be destructive if a person takes it in the wrong direction. And that's why Torah is described as a ruler. You're standing with something very powerful. You're taking dynamite in your hand. You can use it to do productive things, but it can also be destructive. And that's what the Gemara says here. Just as the ruler has the power to give life and death, so too the words of Torah have the power to give life and death. Hainu dama Rava, that's what Rava taught. Lamaiminimba, to those who go in the right direction, they invest their strength and they apply Torah correctly. Sama dechaye, so then Torah is the drug of life. Lamasmeilimba, but to those who misapply Torah, to those who use Torah incorrectly, sama demota, then Torah becomes the drug of death. Torah is not a one-directional cure. Torah is like a drug. You use it correctly, it gives life. But it has to be used correctly. If a person uses Torah as a way of coming down on people, as a way of looking down at people, as a way of controlling people, so then Chazal say, it's a pity that when he was in utero, as a fetus, things didn't get messed up. He should have been a miscarriage. It would have been better for the world. We say, learn Torah, even if you're not doing it right, because mitoch shelo lishma balishma. If I learn Torah so that people respect me, if I learn Torah so that people should honor me, if I learn Torah because I think I'll make money off it, if I learn Torah because I think I'll get a good shidduch out of it, if I learn Torah because I think I'll get a hidden life out of it, that's fine. Because I'm not doing it to hurt anyone. I'm doing it for my benefit. As I grow, I can work on becoming a better person and learning Torah for more pure intent. The more pure my intent, the more I'll have a positive impact on the world. But if I'm learning Torah to hurt other people, I'm learning Torah so I can tell other people where they're wrong. I'm learning Torah so that I can show other people that I'm great and they're not. If I only want to show them that I'm great, that's okay. Right? Someone once told me there are three types of people in the world. There are people who say, I'm great, and they keep telling you how great they are. There are people who think they're going to be great by telling you how lousy you are. And then there are people who think they're going to be great by doing both. They're going to tell you how great they are and how lousy you are. If that component is there, that through Torah we're going to put someone else down, then Chazal say, don't learn Torah. If I learn Torah, my intentions aren't pure, but they're not going to hurt anyone else. I'm not going to put down anyone else. So then, fine. Chazal said, keep learning Torah. Even if it's without pure intent, that's great. You'll get there. You don't start off with pure intent. No one does. Like the Rambam says, when a kid starts learning Torah, you tell him, learn Torah, I'll give you candies. And then he grows up and you tell him, learn Torah, I'll get you good shoes. And you say, I'll get you a good suit. And then you tell him, I'll give you money. And then you say, learn Torah, because if you succeed, they'll call you rabbi. And then he's a rabbi and they tell him, learn Torah, because then they'll call you a judge. And then they tell him, learn Torah, so you'll be a chief rabbi. Meaning there's always that, you grow because you need a drive. And the drive isn't pure. To say, I want to learn Torah, so they'll call me rabbi, is not pure. To say, I want to be chief rabbi is not pure. But it seems like even as you get ahead, you're tainted. It's not so easy to get to a point where you're so pure. That's what Rambam's saying. Even on high levels, we're tainted. We're not pure. But that's okay. That's fine. That's how we grow. So long as the intent is not to hurt others. So long as the intent is not to put down others. This distinction is made by Tosfos in Tractate Kiddushin. And it is ruled in the Shulchan Aruch, in the laws of learning Torah. Bini, just a second. Davar Acher, another opinion. Negidim, I just want to end the thought. So next week we start with a new thought. Kol dibu v'dibu sheyatza mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu kosherin lo shenei ketarim. Everything Hashem said would have two crowns. When Hashem said a commandment, so the people saw the commandments. When the people saw the commandments, they saw them with two crowns. That means, on some level, when we hear the words of Torah, it's important that we understand we are getting the words of the Ribon Shel Olam. We're getting something that's crowned. When a person approaches Torah, sometimes our approach is a critical difference. If a person says, "Yeah, I'm in Machon Meir, we don't have adequate heat. I'm in Machon Meir, the meals here aren't so great. I'm in Machon Meir, I can have all kinds of complaints. Look at the table, the edges are worn, the seats are old-fashioned." I can say a lot of things about Machon Meir. Or I can say, I'm in Machon Meir, and I'm getting the most precious things in the world. I'm in Machon Meir, and I am learning to be the most refined person in the world. I'm in Machon Meir, and I'm being given access to the greatest knowledge in the world. I'm in Machon Meir and I have tremendous opportunities in my life. And I want to end with a story, a personal story. 6 years ago, 7 years ago, there was a new yeshiva opening up. And this new yeshiva wanted me on their staff. And when they wanted me on their staff, so they said, "We want you, but we want you full time." I said, "How much time do you want?" They said, "We want X number of hours." I said, "I can give you close to that," and we came to an agreement. Then they said, "We want you on the condition that you're fully focused on us." I said, we discussed hours and that's fine. And they said, "No, we want you on condition you leave Machon Meir." And I said, "No." And they made it sound like, "If you don't leave Machon Meir, then we're not interested." And I said, "That's okay. I'm not doing that." And they said, "We'll offer you double whatever Machon Meir pays you, but you have to leave Machon Meir." And I said, "No." And I spent the next 5 years teaching in that institution. And every year when the year would end, they would come to me and say, "We want you full time here." And I'd say, "How many hours do you want?" And we'd come to an agreement. And they'd say, "We want you and not in Machon Meir. We want you focused here." And I'd always say, "No, I'm not leaving Machon Meir." And I stuck to it to the point where they finally let me go. They finally said, you're dedicated to Machon Meir and you're not fully with us." And I said, "You're right. I'm not leaving Machon Meir." And I'm telling you this because a part of why did the people have to see crowns on the Torah they were receiving? Because we have to appreciate what we're getting. I had a ride with a certain Jew on the way home from the wedding last week. And I said to that Jew, I said, you know, I learned a very important lesson when I came to teach my first class in Mahon Meir. I was sick like a dog. I was vomiting on my way to teach my first class here. And then I called someone and I said, you know, I'm sick. Maybe we should cancel class. And the person said to me, if you don't teach them, they won't learn Torah. And I said, you know, I'm throwing up. And he said, if you don't teach them, they won't learn Torah. I walked into Mahon Meir to the class and I said, excuse me, guys. And I went to the restroom and threw up another few times. And then I came back to teach the class. And I said to the driver, I said, you know, you're the man who told me to come teach the class. It was Rav Listman. I said, you taught me the lesson of a lifetime. By telling me, I understand you don't feel well, but if you don't teach them, I don't have a replacement tonight. They won't learn Torah. It was my first, I taught here on volunteer basis. I wasn't getting a penny. But he said to me, if you don't teach, they won't learn Torah. Rav Listman taught me the crowns we just learned about. He taught me the value of what we're doing here at Mahon Meir. He said, if you don't teach, I understand you don't feel well, but I understand the guys came to learn Torah. People turned their lives around to come here and learn. The people had to see crowns on the words of Torah. We have to see crowns on the words of Torah. Sometimes people make tremendous moves to come here to Mahon Meir to learn. And then when they're here, it's easy to forget the value of what you're getting. It's easy to forget how precious what we're learning is. The fact that there are millions of people out there who don't have access to this. They don't know what they're missing. You guys have it. I think that's part of the message of the Gemara here. That when the people saw the words of Torah, Hashem had two crowns on every commandment that came out. Because we have to look at the words of Torah and see the crowns, the wonderful gift that we're getting as we're learning the Torah.